Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. Whether your family has been on this journey for years or you're just getting started, we're here to support and encourage you along the way. And now your hosts, Lynette Ezell and Tara Melber.
Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. I'm Lynette Ezell here with Sweet Tara Melber. And today we'd like to welcome again Anna Palmer. Anna, thanks for being with us again.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, Anna and her husband, they're foster and adoptive parents, and you are the executive director of Crossroads NOLA, which is a nonprofit in New Orleans. You recruit, you develop, you support foster families from local churches, and your story has been fascinating.
It is. So, Anna, we would like for you to share with us about what Crossroads NOLA is and how it began.
Okay, sure. So, several years ago, I guess 6 or 7 years ago now, I was on staff at First Baptist Church in New Orleans, and I was the missions minister. And so part of my job in that role was to kind of be aware of the various needs in our community and mobilize our congregation to meet those needs where we could do so effectively. So as part of that role, one of the things that happened was I was invited to a meeting that the Department of Children and Family Services had for pastors and church leaders. And essentially their plea to us was this: we are in desperate need of foster families, and you people, you pastors, you church leaders, y'all have, pews full of really great families in your churches every weekend, but we don't have access to them, and we don't think they understand this or know about this need. And I had at this time just adopted my oldest son from Ethiopia, and so adoption was kind of on my radar, but foster care really was not. And so I left that meeting going, oh my gosh, they're absolutely right. Like, I can't believe I've missed this. I can't believe the church has missed this, because at that time there weren't really any churches in the greater New Orleans area who were doing anything to address this need. And so I left going, man, if I didn't know about this, I know that our people don't know about this. And we clearly have a biblical mandate to care for the fatherless. And although children in foster care have living biological parents most of the time, they are effectively fatherless. They are wards of the state when they are in foster care. And so
that's right.
This is the church's job. This is the church's job. And so we have to do something. We can't, once our eyes are open, we can't walk away from it. And so we went back and we started, we did a recruiting event at our church, and we had 5 or 6 families step forward and say, I feel like this is something God's calling us to do. So we'd recruited some families who were willing to support those who were going to foster. And then, unfortunately, we had, of those 6 families, I think 4 of them, it took them, DCFS, it took them 18 months or more to get those families through the certification process.
Yeah. You lose families that way. So, yep.
Right. And so we realized very quickly, we can't really recruit families and then throw them into this system that's not really, even though the system desperately needs them, the system isn't really equipped to handle them. And so at that point, it wasn't a problem I was willing to walk away from. And I knew we had to stay engaged. And so just at that point, I was, okay, so this means going a little deeper than we originally thought. So we began asking questions, trying to figure out, get a kind of understand the system. And about that same time, our church here, First Baptist, had a partnership with Habitat for Humanity and a local nonprofit they had started. And in partnership with Habitat, they were building homes in the Upper North Ward in New Orleans. And that was a fantastic project that happened after Katrina and went on for years and years. But that project was wrapping up and the executive director was moving on. And so they asked me to consider taking the nonprofit in addition to my role as missions minister. And I'm thinking, I just got this kid now. I'm a mom. I'm, got this part-time gig. I'm good. And I hate to admit it, but it took them kind of coming to me 2 or 3 times before I finally gave them the old, I'll pray about it, which really is a way of saying, I'm just going to tell you no in 2 weeks. but when I opened myself up to that, it was within a couple of days that God really showed me, this nonprofit vehicle is what you need to really mobilize the church to address the needs in the foster care system. And so that's really what Crossroads NOLA became. So long story short, I wrote a grant, got the grant, which means, okay, now I have to execute this plan we've laid out. And so I resigned actually from my position at First Baptist, but I told them I'm going to need to keep this office and this computer. So they were gracious and allowed me to do that. And they continue to be, our offices are still here even 4 or 5 years later. And so they allowed me to stay, and they continue to be just a fabulous support. But what we've done since then is we've gone out and recruited church partners from all over the greater New Orleans area. And so we have over 40 church partners in this area who allow us to come in and just talk to their folks about foster care and share about the need in our community and then mobilize people to respond to that need. So we now have nearly 50 foster families we've recruited from local churches, and they've served well over 150 of the most vulnerable children in our city here. And so we're just excited really to be a part of what God's doing, but in the city. And one of the things we learned really early on is how important it was to support those families. So when we recruit a family, we really make a commitment to them that they're not going to foster alone. And so we walk with them through that development process. We have a great partnership with Louisiana Baptist Children's Home. They have a social worker that's very much part of our team, offices with us. And when we recruit a family, she writes the home study. And so she walks with families, you know, asking the tough questions, making sure families understand, look, foster care is about reunification first and foremost. And, you know, what are the hard questions you want to go to God with before that happens to you? Before you have a baby that you have loved and cared for, and now they're being reunited with biological family, you know, go ahead and ask God those hard questions now. And so that development process is really important. And then on the back end, support. And one of the things we know is that, you know, like I mentioned in the last cast, that we want our families to obviously love unconditionally, like Christ shows us, but we also want them to be competent in their parenting, and that parenting a child who's experienced trauma, which every child in foster care has, requires a certain set of knowledge and skills, and we want to make sure that they have that. And so we offer trainings on trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI, and it's just been a powerful tool that gives caregivers the knowledge and skills they need to really, you know, help kids heal from the harm they've experienced.
So can you give us a brief overview of what TBRI is? I know it involves a lot, but just generally.
Yeah, it does involve a lot. But generally speaking, one of the reasons we love it is it's a caregiving model as opposed to a clinical one. So really it takes someone like me who doesn't have any clinical background or experience and gives me the knowledge and skills that I need to bring healing. And so it's evidence-based. So it's research, it's backed by science. It's attachment-based, which means it's about the relationship between the child and the caregiver. And it's all about connection. The primary kind of purpose of TBRI is that a trauma caused by relationship, which is what most kids in foster care have experienced, whether it's neglect or some type of abuse. Trauma caused by relationship can only be healed through relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it really gives caregivers the ability to be that healing connection that kids need to overcome the trauma that they've experienced. And so it's a lot about being proactive and proactive teaching of skills and strategies. But its basis is connection and building that bridge to the child's heart, which ultimately helps you do things that bring the child's brain, you know, that upstairs brain or that prefrontal cortex online, and gives them that ability to regulate their emotions, regulate their behavior, and really ultimately just heal.
You know, Anna, I love that, because I know at our house, at the end of the day, we have 6 children. I don't ever want to lose a relationship with one of my children. And so I love that the TBRI is a matter of the heart. It's it's a matter of building a trusting relationship with a child that was not taught to trust early in their life.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that's kind of a bedrock of really all trauma-informed care and TBRI as well, is this idea of felt safety. So I think as adults, one of the things that's really hard is, you know, we may have this child and we're going like, hey, you've been with us for months. Why are you still hoarding food? Or why are you still scared to go to sleep at night? Like, we know they're safe. We know they're loved. We know we're not going to let anything happen to them. And we feel like they should know that too. But their previous experience does not tell them that. And so one of the things that's important for kids from hard places is this idea of felt safety. So we have to put ourselves in their situation. And even sometimes when we don't understand, to figure out what that child needs to actually feel safe. So not just that they are safe, but that they feel safe. And so for a kid who experienced early neglect and is terrified of not having food, even though we can show them, look, the pantry's full, like the refrigerator's full, I give you dinner every night, you know, like why don't you understand that it's their brain, it's their primitive brain that takes over and has them in that fear state. And so just doing simple things. I know one of my little guys, like I would literally be cooking dinner and he would come in from playing outside and he would say, I'm hungry. And I would say, I mean, like, I'm about to fix your plate. Like, I'm like dishing the hamburger meat into the taco shell. Like we are like about to cross the finish line here. And, you know, I'd say, okay, I'm fixing your plate. And he would say, but I'm hungry now. And I'm like, what is the difference between now and 2 minutes? You know, right. But to him, like hungry now meant hungry now. Mm, and that there was a downstairs brain primitive fear response in him. And literally all I would have to do is say, you know what, here's a granola bar or an apple or a handful
it's
of grapes.
Yep.
You know, you can take that to tide you over. And half the time, by the time he, you know, got the grapes out, you know, dinner was actually ready.
Right.
He just needed to know he could have something right then. And so for some kids, that means you may need to have a little bowl of, you know, sealed up, you know, snacks or whatever. They may need to always have something kind of on them so that they know they have access to that.
I have two of mine that have to have lots of extra in their lunchbox every day because they never got over that.
Right. Even now, years later.
Yeah, years later. I just did it this morning. They have to have at least two of everything in their lunchbox, which half of that's coming back home. But they still, you know, even as they're teenagers, Anna, and they still have to know that there's plenty, you know, that they can see it, that the mind has to see it. And every single day, two of them want to know before they leave for school in the morning, what's for dinner tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've been cooking dinner for like 30 years and I'm tired, but I come up with something. The Lord is sweet every single day, but it's important for them to know, like it's important for mine, even as teenagers. And I got when they were babies, that they can smell it when they come in the side door.
Mm-hmm. I have one that just this morning said he's looking through his lunchbox every single morning. And he looked at me this morning and he said, Mom, I know there's stuff in here and plenty for me. I was just checking.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know where he's coming from. He doesn't have to say, he gives me that look and I know what he's thinking and he knows I know what he's thinking. But it's the continual 7 years later, still doing those same things. But it just grieves my soul.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful that he's come as far as he has. But it's just hard to watch them go through that. But you know that every time that you do that and you reinforce that there is felt safety in our home. It really solidifies his relationship at home to know Mom and Dad have got this. I can trust them. And every day that something like that happens, then it's just a reiteration of I am safe.
Well, you know, Anna, when we were talking to you earlier, when I was talking to you a time before, you had talked about how New Orleans is probably one of the most traumatized cities in the United States. I know because of Katrina and those things that happened. But now you're focused on bringing this TBR training, not just to foster parents, but you've kind of broadened that scope. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So we've recently created what we're calling the Greater New Orleans Collaborative for Children. And it's really an effort just to infuse across the system TBRI training and education and resources, just really recognizing that there's so many different people who are involved in the life of children in foster care. And so we have caseworkers and judges and attorneys and all these folks who are, whether they're providing direct care or they're making decisions, it's just really important that they understand you know, what trauma does to children and how they can apply that information to whatever process or whatever piece of the puzzle they're a part of. And so the goal is to really have a system that prioritizes the needs of children. And a huge part of that is understanding how trauma has affected them. And as a result of that, how we as the grown-ups in the situation need to react and respond and be proactive and make decisions in light of that information.
Right. And when you have everybody on the same page and understanding the same information, then it provides consistency for the children.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's definitely what we're after, is that every child in foster care receives consistent, loving, trauma-informed care from every part of the system.
Are you getting a lot of cooperation with your judges and lawyers and CASA workers and everyone involved?
We are. You know, one of the things that's so great about TBRI is a lot of times when people hear about it, especially people who are in this child welfare work, they hear about it and they go, this is what we've been missing.
Like, wow.
We've heard about the
ACEs
study. Yeah. Yeah, they say, we've heard about, you know, the ACEs study and that, you know, adverse experiences aren't good for kids. We've heard some of this information about trauma, but we've never known, okay, so what do we do in light of that? And TBRI really takes best practices from several trauma-informed care models and research and really just puts together this framework that really gives people the now what. And so, we've had great responses from judges, from attorneys, from CASA, from a variety of organizations across the system. So we're really excited to have partners on board for this effort.
You know, Anna, when you bring in the TBRI training into a foster family or an adoptive family, or, you know, when the workers begin to see this, in your opinion, I'm just asking this, just your personal opinion, how long do you think it takes before you begin to see the actions, the feelings, the emotions of a child to begin to shift a little bit toward more of a relational aspect?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So let me just say here that one of the things that is so great about TBRI, but is simultaneously a challenge, is that, much like many things, it's all about the caregiver's ability to actually implement TBRI. And so when you have a caregiver who has, if they've experienced trauma in their past, they've worked through that, and they have the capacity actually to remain calm and regulated themselves while a child is flipping out. Because I don't know about you, but sometimes my child flips out and then I flip out and then he flips out a little more. And so we get in this cycle of, you know, I told my husband, you know, one time he triggered me first.
It's his fault.
It was him. But the bottom line is when we understand what triggers us, that's a huge part of knowing our own stuff and knowing where we need to do the work. So when a caregiver is able to implement TBRI and to have those healing interactions, we've had families who say, man, it was, you know, almost immediately we began to see growth and capacity building. And so I'm sure it's obviously different for every child, and depending on what type of trauma and how long that trauma persisted, that it takes. But for, I know for our family, it was also pretty quickly. And, you know, sometimes you would get one kind of issue resolved.
That's
and,
right.
And that would allow you to see and focus on another issue. And
right.
So it's just, it's an ongoing process. And still to this day, you know, there are, you know, things that we work on, and we know we need to spend some time doing some proactive teaching and not only be reactive to certain behaviors that we see. But overall, most kids begin to respond, especially with the when you start paying attention. So part of TBRI is paying attention to sensory issues and to just food and drink. One of the things that is really fascinating that research shows is that children who've experienced this early childhood trauma are especially susceptible to dehydration and changes in blood sugar levels. And so when you just start to make sure my child is hydrated and my child, you know, their blood sugar levels are evened out, I'm giving them, you know, balanced snacks in between meals. It's shocking, you know, what I mean, like, I fed my children before, you know, it's not like I wasn't feeding them, but when we started to be really intentional about what that snack was and when that snack was, and that they were staying hydrated, I mean, we saw, you know, really quickly progress even there, which gives you the confidence you need to start to make other changes. The sensory needs are important as well. And so a lot of times what we see as won't behavior is actually can't behavior, because a child can't function because of the sensory deficits that they experience. So they may be a child who's constantly bumping around and flopping on the ground and spinning, and they're sensory seeking, and it looks like they're just being bad. They won't sit still, but really their body needs that extra sensory input to be able to regulate. And so when you start to learn these things, you can see changes pretty quickly when you begin to identify what it is your child needs, and every child's different. Well, so that's a really long answer to a short question.
No, that's great. But I, you know, in a perfect world, we're obviously not in a perfect world because we have foster kids and kids that need to be adopted, and I'm a parent, so that's not a perfect world. Man, the cry of my heart is that every single family entering adoption or foster care would be trained in TBRI.
I agree.
I don't think you can put enough value on that.
Mm-mm.
Yes, I agree.
I agree. Well, I tell you, Anna, this has been such an amazing conversation. I've learned so much just from talking to you, and appreciate your heart for children and your heart for the children of New Orleans. And you know, Psalm 46:1 reassures us that God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. And just this morning, I was reading on Jason Johnson's blog, and he said, in the beautiful, sacrificial, redemptive work you're doing of laying yourself down for the sake of these kids, know that you're not alone. You're never alone. The Lord is good, and He grants us wisdom, and He allows us to not grow weary in doing good. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for your time, and we just appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, listen, it's just amazing to be a part of what God's doing. And so we're humbled by it, and we're blessed by it. And just, it's a joy. So thank you guys for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting with y'all.
Thanks, Anna.
You've been listening to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. We're so glad you've taken time to listen today. Keep in mind, we are a ministry of the North American Mission Board and funded through the Annie Armstrong offering and your giving to the cooperative program. We look forward to talking more about adoption, fostering, and orphan care, and how you can be involved.